Second day of the February Fish and Game Commission meeting. I'm Richard Rogers, president of the commission, newly appointed or elected president for another year. Thank you very much, fellow commissioners. I live in Carpinteria, California. To my left, on the other side of this gentleman, is the vice president of the commission, Cindy Gustafson. So what you have with the two of us is not a quorum, but you do have the varsity, so we're okay. Sitting immediately to my left is John Carlson, who is executive director of the commission. Immediately to my right is Adriana Shea, deputy executive director. John Fisher, deputy executive director over there. A little further on, Bill Cunningham, deputy attorney general. We have Sherry Cole, Sherry Tiemann. Let me see, that's our staff. John McCammon, director of the department. Sankey Mastrup, deputy director. Chief Foley, also of enforcement. Maria Vojkovic, Maria's back there. Eric Loft is here. Let's see, Neil Mangi. Neil, are you around? Well, you're supposed to be. Anyway, he will be here. So as soon as John gets back, we will continue on. Oh, we do have another warden here. Travis Fuick. Good morning. Thank you. John, take it away.
Good morning. We did not finish yesterday's agenda, so we're going to start there and work our way through into today's agenda. If you would like to speak on any items, please turn in a speaker card to the staff on the table here. And just want to remind everyone, we're live streaming over the internet, and the copy of the meeting from yesterday and today will be available in an archive form via our website also in the future. With that, we'll start with item number 11, DFG legislative report update and possible consideration of commission positions on proposed legislation. DFG Acting Director John McCammon has some comments on that.
Mr. President, thank you very much this morning again. We've got a brief legislative report. The deadline to introduce bills is February 22nd. Departmental staff will provide a complete legislative update at the next commission meeting when those bills are introduced. Regarding Fish and Game sponsored bills, so far we have the governor's office approval for several bills, including a bill to extend the Natural Resources Heritage Tax Credit Program that operates out of WCV. That provides a tax credit for land donations for the purposes of resource conservation. We've got approval to move a bill to modify the method in which DFG manages endowment funds held as mitigation for development projects and other environmental disturbances, and a bill to end the competition between DFG and its license agents by standardizing the hunting and fishing license fee no matter where it is purchased. This bill will also clarify junior hunting license provisions. This year, we're expecting a number of bills relating to the Office of Spill Prevention and Response, as well as inland oil spills, and trying to clarify the authority for inland oil spills. This is the last year of the two-year legislative cycle, so things will move very quickly this year. And depending upon the outcome of the Prop 93 election, which we now know it didn't at the time, we can expect to see a lot of movement as members of the legislature jockey for leadership positions. That's the substance of the legislative report.
Yeah, I'm aware that Assemblyman Nava was rather angry at having to suffer through the 204th in 1 year violation of Greca Energy's little spill-happy operation they run in Santa Barbara County, in San Luis Obispo County.
And so we're working.
They're going to go after him and really jump on him, I hope.
It's both being pursued. The legislature is engaged and interested in that issue. Actually, it's come up in the context of discussion about inland oil pollution legislation and the appropriate sanctions for that kind of behavior. And frankly, I think we'll be seeing both criminal and civil charges coming out of the department's operations as well as legislative activity.
Yeah, Assemblyman Nava was focused on serious financial penalties. I didn't know they were going to involve criminal.
Well, and our authority on financial liability is relatively limited, and we're trying to fix that.
That's why he knew that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We have a speaker card for this issue from yesterday, Jim Martin. Okay, and so we'll move to item number 12, receipt of DFG Director's Report.
Mr. President, again, John McCammon, Acting Director. A couple of items just for a quick update. One is the budget process. We've gone through, as you're aware, we prepared a budget at the governor's direction, which provided 10% across-the-board reductions in general fund appropriations for the department. Our general fund is basically in two areas of the department, biodiversity conservation, which is issues such as timber harvest plan review, CEQA, the Environmental Quality Act, CESA, the Endangered Species Act, and NCCP administration, Natural Communities Conservation Planning. Those areas are anticipated with that 10% reduction to lose 22 positions. In addition, the other major area of general fund in the department, which is also proposed for a 10% reduction, is in enforcement, which the 10% reduction is about $2.6 million, as I recollect, and is consists of 38 warden positions. Those positions are currently vacant. There are 63 vacancies as of last report. But we do have a warden class of over 30 positions going through the class beginning last week.
Assuming they don't get poached.
Right. Correct. So that's the update on the budget. I'd be happy to answer any questions. We have had the governor did declare an emergency, and the legislature is in a 45-day emergency process of reducing the current year budget pursuant to the terms of Prop 58. But included in that discussion is discussion of the ongoing effects, so we're looking at budget year as well. And the questions that we've received have largely been about our fee capacity. Our general suggestion to the legislature when asked about fee capacity is that fees are largely set in statute, and it would be more appropriate to give the commission authority to deal with fees and be able to review them on a regular basis. So that's the general approach we've taken. The other update, I think, is some good news on Lake Davis. This week, the Department of Public Health has certified Lake Davis waters as consumable, fit for human consumption, and therefore flows have resumed out of Lake Davis. The fish have been planted. We planted a number of large fish before the freeze and are planting a very large hatchery plant as soon as the ice breaks up. So the restoration of Lake Davis as a premier trout fishery is well on its way. So that was good news for Lake Davis. And then I have some PowerPoints on what's going on with zebra mussels, and I'd like to get that if I could. The other one. There's another one on there. Yep. The zebra mussels have been found in California for the first time. You've heard previously about quagga mussel infestation. Quaggas and zebras are related. They're in the Dracenid family, so we have both versions. The primary difference is that actually quagga mussels are a little more. They have a higher survivability quotient. They go deeper in the water column and are not. It's not necessary for them to have a hard substrate to survive. So having both is particularly bad. These are the, I think it was 10 places where mussels have been found beginning in January 07 in the Colorado River. And then the related aqueduct and the next eight items are where raw water from the Colorado River is distributed in California, most of those being along the MWD aqueduct system and into the San Diego County reservoir system. So there were quagga mussels found in that entire Colorado River distribution system. We had our first find of zebra mussels in January of this year in San Justo Reservoir in San Benito County, just south of Hollister. San Justo Reservoir is in the San Felipe unit of the Central Valley Project. It's owned by the Bureau of Reclamation. It's supplied by local water and water from the San Luis Reservoir. And the water source for San Benito Water Agency, it's the water source, and it's used for agriculture, municipal, and industrial uses. Recreation includes fishing from non-power boats in the shoreline. It's about a 200-acre reservoir. And we are, as a result of that find, doing surveys to determine if mussels are in adjacent reservoirs and the extent of the mussel infestation in San Justo. And those evaluations will begin actually today. Divers and service crews have been deployed to look for mussels throughout that system. And the results of a Department of Water Resources remote observation vehicle surveys in January. They have placed DWR larval settling plates and plankton toes taken by the department during the summer are negative for zebra mussels in San Luis Reservoir, but we're going back to look again. A control eradication plan is being developed for San Justo Reservoir, and once results of the surveys are available, partners will determine next steps. We work this coordinated with the owners of the aqueduct. Another specific area of concern is that recreational access in a number of reservoirs throughout California has been, there's threats to closures of those accesses. That's concern to you because of provision of fishing opportunities will become increasingly limited. We're working with reservoir operators to ensure continued access for recreational purposes, but we have to have a comprehensive solution identified and funded to avoid infected boats being placed in those reservoirs. So the pressure for closures will continue until that solution is identified. You can see on this map the infestations, and then you see up top the San Justo Reservoir, clearly a separate infection from likely boat placement, and it's zebra as opposed to quagga mussels. We did receive legislation last year, AB 1683, which provided additional authorities for the department to conduct inspections, order quarantines, and take necessary actions in concert with reservoir owners to address invasive species. So that's the latest update on that. The other update item is salmon. You've been seeing some press lately on condition of salmon, and Maria will handle that during the PFMC update.
I think we're going to go right now to the PFMC update. But
actually,
no?
Item A.
Oh, A. Indeed.
Item 12A, update on the California Board of Forestry and Commission joint policy on Pacific salmon and anadromous trout.
Hey, listen, you were in the parking lot or something. You weren't here when I introduced you. So.
Oh, okay.
I thought you weren't here.
Good morning.
We need to be admonished.
Publish it.
Good morning.
Yourself publicly admonished.
I'm glad I'm able to speak early this morning. I guess yesterday was a very long day.
Yes, it certainly was.
Acting Director McCammon asked me to speak briefly on the update of the joint policy with Sandwich Steelhead with the Board of Forestry. The Department of Fish and Game has been working very closely with George Gentry with the Board of Forestry to work on a document that has been very difficult in trying to merge two points of views from the Department's perspective, the Commission's perspective, and the Board of Forestry. I'd like to report now that we have final comments from the Board of Forestry. The Department is incorporating those comments and will be putting together the final draft for the regional review then to the directorate for review and sent to the commission. I believe that is no more than about a 2 weeks away, because we're going to allow at least a week for comments from the regions, at which time the department will take a look at it and forward it to the commission staff to take a look at it. So in terms of planning, obviously leave it up to the commission staff, but the document should be ready to be jointly reviewed by both the board and the commission, I would think, by their April meeting. So we're close.
Good. Thanks, Neil. Now I'll go to the update on the PFMC. But before we do, I need to introduce someone who is relevant to that discussion, and that's Don Hansen, who is currently the sitting chair of the PFMC. Don lives in Dana Point, has all his life. Maria?
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. I have many bosses here today, so I better be on top of everything. Yes, the Pacific Fishery Management Council will be meeting the first meeting of this 2008 in March in Sacramento, and we invite, of course, the commission and the public to that meeting. This year it is scheduled for 6 days instead of 5 days, and the salmon issues will be primarily on Tuesday of that week, so I'll remind you in the end also. But relative to salmon, I'm sure that you've seen the newspaper reports. My report has a little bit of good news and probably more bad news than we'd like to be dealing with. But if you remember in the past few years when I've stood in front of you talking about salmon, it has been primarily about the Klamath fall Chinook stock and how limiting that has been for both our river fishing and our ocean fishing. This year, for the first time in 4 years, the salmon spawners have met their conservation objective in their returning spawners to the river. That's very good news. Because that run was successful this year, we probably will not be looking at severe management actions for that stock in 2008. And so it's probably reasonable to assume that there may be some Klamath fish available for harvest. How much, we don't know at this stage. We're in the early process of that whole determination. The bad news is about the Central Valley stocks. It was surprising that that stock did not meet its conservation objective this year, and that the preliminary data show that in addition to the adults not returning to the river, that the jacks, or the two-year-old fish that usually portend what's to come in the following year, was the lowest on record, and that's an order of magnitude than the last low period, which was in 06. So it's very severe indications at this point. We're looking into all of the reasons why this may have been or what may have affected these results, but we don't have that currently. We do know that both the natural spawning fish and the hatchery fish show the same signal. So it's system-wide. And the Central Valley stocks are really the stocks on which our fisheries depend along the entire West Coast. Probably 80% of what's taken for salmon comes from the Central Valley stocks. So the effects of this severe decline are going to be not only felt in California, in the ocean, and possibly the river, or rivers, it's also going to be felt in Oregon and parts of Washington in the ocean. So this is pretty dramatic, and you can be guaranteed that there will be considerable discussion and analysis and creativity in what we may be doing for salmon this year.
A question, if I may, Maria,
sure.
On that. yesterday we were dealing, as perhaps you noticed, with the longfin smelt, also a collapse, also a pelagic. Well, they are a pelagic in the sense that you couldn't call them an anadromous, I guess. Or maybe you could. No? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think there's any connectivity here? I mean, do we, you know, we don't pull a whole bunch of salmon smolt through the pumps. But it really does make you wonder if some of the other commentary that we were hearing yesterday with respect to nitrate pollution, with respect to, you know, all kinds of things that are potentially going on, maybe affecting all of the stocks in that whole estuary.
That particular question is one that we're exploring just to make sure we've covered all the bases of the possibilities and looking at where other things are affected. There's also been some speculation about just ocean conditions, and so we're looking there to see what's happening, because a lot of the salmon stocks are experiencing the same kind of decline, the same signal all along the Pacific coast.
Well, there was an upwelling change, wasn't there?
Yes.
Of some substance.
The last few years. Yeah. And so that's all part of what we're going to be doing between now and April at the council, where we make the final decision as to how much fishing might be able to be taking place, certainly in California, but everywhere else along the coast. So relative to the public opportunities for salmon, I've got a little schedule up here where first we're going to get a full report of what happened last year in the salmon fishery, and then what does the abundance projection look like. And that comes out at the end of February. So that will be the first time we have the full report, where staff have analyzed all the numbers and corrected all the mistakes, and we'll really know what we're dealing with at that point. The department will be hosting, in the past we've been hosting an informational meeting prior to the council meeting. We will be doing that again the first week of March, and that's an opportunity for the public to hear the information and then also provide the council members. We were going to have several council members at the meeting from California, what the public's interest is and how we negotiate, if there's any salmon, how we negotiate with Oregon and Washington for our share. Then,
quick, on that number two, the meeting the first week of March, is there a location, date yet?
And we're looking at either the 4th or the 5th. Right now we're looking, trying to figure out how many people might show up to the meeting to determine where the meeting might be, but it may be in Sacramento as the most central location. And so then we have the commission meeting the first week, that at the end of that week, and then we have the council meeting the following week. And I mentioned that we first take up salmon issues on Tuesday. It's pretty much the whole day. And then during the week, of course, we refine the range of alternatives that the public would consider throughout the week. Again, I want to invite you to come to the council meeting on that Tuesday if you can. I think it's very informative, and you get the total picture of what the situation might be. Then the council holds some public meetings themselves. We have one scheduled for April in Eureka. And then the decision-making meeting in April will be in Seattle. And then, of course, you have the April meeting to take public comment, and then we have scheduled a teleconference that following week to have you make the final decision on recreational California regulations. So any questions for me? I think that's all I'll give you as far as an update for PFMC. That's the most major issue right now on our platter.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks.
Item 12C, update on enforcement, Chief Nancy Foley. And earlier on the quagga update, I didn't hear you mention the dogs that are detecting quagga, but
dogs.
I'll give you the update on who let the dogs out. Commissioners, Nancy Foley, Chief of the Law Enforcement Division. Just a quick update. I'll give you the good news first. The good news is that the Canine Academy started about 3 weeks ago. We had six dogs in it with their handlers, and they have one week left to go, and they're all doing well above what they expected. All of the dogs are detecting quagga mussels. All of them, or one of them is detecting quagga suspended in water. So it's something that's groundbreaking, really. They're doing a great job. They're also learning how to, they're also picking up scents on gunpowder, abalone, bear, and deer. So they're really doing some amazing things. And they'll graduate at the end of next week. So we're all looking forward to that. The other good news is that we started our Fish and Game Academy on Monday of this week. It was good news for the department, good news for the commission, good news for the people of the state of California, but I think we had 29 people in the academy that were wondering if it was good news for them or not. When they learn how to stand at attention and go through inspections and have people look at their boots and strings coming out of their buttons, I saw it in their eyes. They were like thinking, uh-oh, what have I gotten myself into? But afterwards, we had a nice long talk about why each one of them was in the academy and wanted to be a fish and game warden. And I can tell you that you would all be very proud of those people that we have there. Not all of them are lifetime hunters or anglers, but they all have a tremendous respect for the resource, and they want to do a job that matters. So I'm very proud of the people that are in there. I hope that we can hang on to all of them through the academy process. We also have four people in there that are self-sponsored cadets. And those are people that want to be game wardens eventually, but they didn't either have the credits to be a game warden or hadn't gone through the background and testing process yet. So they're paying their own way through the Fish and Game Academy and hope to be picked up at a later point.
What is the cost for those people?
I don't know for sure. It would be the cost of tuition for about 50 units. And then the added expenses of ammunition and the driving school and all of that. And 22 weeks of their life.
That's dedicated.
Yes, sir, it is. The other good news is that we have 19 lateral candidates in the background process. Those are pre-existing peace officers that have decided that they want to be game wardens. The good news of that is that 19 of them want to come over because they, too, want to do something that matters. The bad news is that they also are really set where they're living, and they need openings in the areas where they are. So we're trying to accommodate as many of those as possible through our hiring process. So if you put all of that together, we have 370 sworn positions within the Law Enforcement Division. We had 63 vacancies. That number is really a moving target, because on any given day we can have people either separate or retire. So 63 today, we have 29 in the academy. We have the potential for 19 laterals, but then in the governor's proposed budget there's a 38 position reduction, and that will then impact where we are with our hiring. And as you all know, we've had the challenge of trying to fill our ranks for a very long time. We've taken that challenge. We changed a one game warden position into a full-time recruiter. They've gone out. We've made concerted efforts up and down the state to be at shows and events and public appearances. We've gotten people to come in, not at the numbers that we would like. So we're getting to the place where we'd actually have 370 game wardens. And now with a 10% reduction drill, we're facing the challenges of eliminating positions. So that's the difficulty where we are, and we've been spending a lot of time responding not only to constituents but senators and assembly people as well. So that's the challenging news at best for where we are with that. The other concern that we have is that whenever you talk about reductions in hiring or layoffs, it impacts your ability to recruit, certainly from existing peace officers but also from potential candidates. And we expect that if people believe that we're going to lay anybody off, that it will have at least a 3-year impact on our hiring, maybe as much as 5 years. So we're facing some significant challenge budgetarily and with positions, but we know that most of the people are very interested in game wardens. We've had a lot of very positive comments, and we'll see where it takes us. On the poaching front, I say this every time I'm up here, I'm very concerned about what's happening to our wildlife. There was a great case made in Sacramento with some convicted felons and some people that had known gang activity just out poaching deer. They were selling them for $50 each. There were two full deer in the backyard that had not been gutted, and they'd been shot the night before when they served the search warrant. The deer were still there. It was a couple of does, a fawn, maybe one buck. There's some connection to a case earlier where they found two deer in the back of the trunk as well as a dead red-tailed hawk. In my own backyard, which is a national forest, I found five dead deer over the last weekend. And poaching is, it's not only the deer population, but it's all the populations, all of the species, and I remain very concerned. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy, for lightening up our day.
12D, update on groundfish status and potential for regulation actions in 2008 based on in-season adjustments. Maria Vojkovich.
More great news. Thank you. Maria Vojkovich with the Marine Region. I just wanted to give the commission and the public a heads up. As you know, we set groundfish management options, seasons, in a two-year cycle, and in 2006, we at the council and you set the recreational season for 2007 and 2008. Because we got our data through 2007 and looked at what we actually caught or estimate that anglers caught, and our harvest guidelines for some of our overfished species, the one area that we appeared to exceed our allotment was with yellow-eye rockfish. It's a species that's at its extent of its range in Northern California. It is one of our largest rockfishes, and it's fairly well, it's distributed in a wide range of depths. This past year, it appeared that we had anglers who ran into them more frequently than we had anticipated. So we're thinking that we're going to have to alter the 2008 season structure in those areas where those high catches were reported. We're working at how do we reduce the catch or the projected catch, and also allow as much fishing opportunity as possible. So for the next few months, we'll be working on that in conjunction with our salmon challenge, because when people can't go salmon fishing, they tend to go for groundfish. So not only will the council be grappling with salmon issues, we have to also think of how that's going to affect groundfish opportunities. I just wanted to give you a heads up. I don't know exactly what we're going to do or exactly when at this stage, but we're looking at changing how many months fishermen have an opportunity, where exactly they might be able to fish as far as depth or area on the coast. We may be able to look at some specific closure areas for no fishing for groundfish to try and leave the opportunities open, but at this stage we're not ready to let you know what might really be the possibility. I just wanted to give a heads up.
Thank you, Maria.
12E, update on San Miguel Island abalone resource. And I guess the question is to the commissioners also is this item we've been having on the agenda every month. I think that there's some indication from the department, and I'd like a confirmation that we might put this on maybe only quarterly or twice a year, but we could have a little discussion on that too.
Great. Thank you, Commissioners. Maria Vojkovich again for the region. Just to let you know, the I think the last time we spoke about this, we said that the advisory group was going to be having a meeting at the end of November, and they did meet with their full complement of advisors. They're working on this allocation management options, continuing to work on that. The technical panel that was established for actually doing the biological assessment met also with the contractor who is going to be doing the assessment. And so they went through what types of models they might do for the stock assessment, what kind of data were available, talked about the data, and some of the members of the group, the advisory group, were in attendance and giving input. So that's from the group and the process of discussion of whether we have enough abalone and what we might do with them. As far as the surveys are concerned, we completed those in the end of October and had four separate cruises from July through mid-October, and they surveyed 133 stations. So that work was completed in this last year. And that's about the end, you know, end of the update. And it is true that doing this on a meeting my beanie basis might be a little overkill. So it might be best to either think of this on a quarterly basis, or when we get to a stage where we have something really to report, like the first results of the stock assessment, that type of thing might be more appropriate.
How about we ask the department to come back to us with a proposed schedule rather than forcing quarterly at this point? You know, that may be slightly premature given the reporting schedule. So why don't we just see what you guys have to say and at our next meeting come back to us with something you think works.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
Thank you, Maria.
12F, update on the Klamath River Basin Restoration Agreement. John McCammon.
Commissioners, John McCammon, Acting Director. I'm giving the update today on the Klamath River Basin Restoration Agreement for the sustainability of public and trust resources and communities. As you're aware, the Department and the Resources Agency have been working for over 3 years in confidential settlement negotiations on issues related to the Klamath Basin. Greg Herner and Don Cook have been the Department's representative in those negotiations, and they have taken a great deal of effort. The document that was published on January 15th is some 270 pages. The group has released that document, and it's what we believe can lead to a comprehensive and durable solution for resolving the conflict in the basin. Parties include the states of California and Oregon, federal agencies, 4 tribal governments, commercial fishermen, counties in Oregon and California, agricultural groups, and conservation organizations.
That's an easy group to get on the same page.
There's 26 of them, and it's been pretty interesting to watch from a distance, I'll tell you.
Yeah, that'd be the best place to watch it,
It certainly was. I was glad I wasn't there. The Klamath River Basin Restoration Agreement achieves the following objectives. It provides for a reliable allocation of water sufficient for maintenance of a sustainable agricultural community in the Klamath Irrigation Project, reduction of the economic impact of increasing power rates on agriculture and the National Wildlife Refuge, provision of stable fundings to support tribes, cooperative efforts in the fisheries reintroduction and restoration program, and support for tribal economic renewal. Allocation of economic development funds to the counties sufficient to offset the loss of revenues from the decommissioning and removal of project facilities. Provision of increased water inflow to Upper Klamath Lake and increased available water storage in Upper Klamath Lake. Provision of sufficient water for the maintenance and enhancement and reintroduction of anadromous and native aquatic species throughout the Upper Klamath River watershed and to support sustainable tribal, recreational, and commercial fisheries. Provision of sufficient water for operation of the National Wildlife Refuge, prevention of new regulatory impacts to communities related to the reintroduction and restoration of anadromous and native aquatic species, and that's it. The department is optimistic that a final solution can be reached and that over 300 miles of habitat will be reopened to anadromous species. On the slide in the area in blue represents the area that was cut off to Chinook and Steelhead in 1918 with the creation of a dam series there. 300 miles of anadromous stream is pretty meaningful. Of course, access to this historic area requires an agreement to be reached with PacifiCorp, the owner of the dams, and the hydroelectric project generally. Pictured in this slide are the four lower dams on the Klamath River. The basin agreement is contingent on the development of an acceptable corollary agreement with the company, and confidential negotiations to come to that agreement are continuing. Meanwhile, we will work with the commission staff to arrange time on a future agenda when we can provide a more full briefing on the basin agreement and the negotiations with the corporation as they proceed. That's it for my report.
Thank you, John.
12G, update on report status regarding pink strip trawling bycatch reduction devices. Maria.
Thank you. If you'll remember, I believe in October you took some action, or did not take action, relative to the pink shrimp fishery. And concurrent with that, there was the need to do some cleanup in Title 14 to make those regulations now reflect the fact that we're not allowing pink shrimp fishing in some of the state areas. There was also a mention by public about one of the bycatch reduction devices that are allowed in those the existing or remaining fishery. And so staff have almost completed an initial statement of reason to do the cleanup and consider the removal of one of the authorizations for the bycatch reduction device. And I suspect that that would be available for your March or April meeting.
Maria, there's also, at the last meeting, there was some discussion. At least one commissioner was interested in a report on the different bycatch reduction devices that were out there. And that's kind of what we were looking is, you know, we had talked about bringing it, having the department bring it to this meeting, but then we were informed it wasn't ready yet. Would kind of get an idea of if that could be coming along too. And this could be a brief report, but my understanding was during some of those talks, at least one commissioner was interested in, you know, just an update on what is out there as far as these reduction devices and what they basically entail.
And my understanding is this is from a literature search or connection with other states that are using some other device, because the department has no data on any of the bycatch reduction devices ourselves. Is that correct?
We're asking you, actually. I'm not sure. I mean, if you don't have that information, basically, here, if you guys are going to be bringing an eyesore with this, what kind of background information is there on this?
The three devices that are currently allowed at the time they were put into place, they were the accepted bycatch reduction devices that were available on the Pacific Coast with any information from the state of Oregon, actually. Over the years, there has been more information about the efficacy of some of those devices. So we can bring what information there might have been obtained in the last few years, but I don't know how much more information might be available and the applicability of a bycatch reduction device in other fisheries to this one. There's probably no connection.
That sounds fine.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I don't know if we have anything else under 12H, other. Did the department have anything?
No, I believe we've covered it.
Yeah, we have two public speaker cards under item 12, Jim Martin and Paul Weakland.
Thank you, Mr. President. Jim Martin, Recreational Fishing Alliance. I wanted to comment on the PFMC issues. I'm a groundfish advisor to the council, and I work with Maria and Don Hansen there. I'm concerned about this suggestion that we need an in-season adjustment for rockfish in northern and central California in this year. The reason why is that I haven't seen the data yet for the actual catch data. We discussed it, we had it referred to, but at this point it still hasn't been published. So as an advisor on these issues, I don't know how to make management recommendations. If we know that, say, there's a lot of yellow-eye being caught out of one port, we could make an adjustment there, but I haven't seen it. So another question I have is, you know, yellow-eye, we're at the southern end of their range in northern California, and we're also not allowed to fish in federal waters. So the yellow-eye that we're keeping are inshore, and basically the whole mass of their population is protected by the Rockfish Conservation Area. We're facing a really bad situation with salmon this year, and I'd like the commission's support and the department's help in fighting for every scrap of fishing opportunity that we can get out of this council. We're looking at really hard times in Northern California, so thank you.
I'm reasonably certain that I can speak for the rest of my fellow commissioners that we are going to be fighting for every scrap of fishing opportunity. And what is the protocol may I ask the department, what is the protocol for that information being shared with the partners who obviously need to be able to operate with that? Maria, did you catch that question? What is the protocol? Sorry, you were suitably engaged. What is the protocol for sharing that information? It's been out since, what, November?
No, we haven't. Last week was when my staff got the numbers through the model. So we will be engaging with our task force and discussing this with the industry. And that's why I mentioned that over the next few months we're going to be trying to grapple with this and the salmon issues.
So I think what you're sensing, and what certainly we are sensing, is that because of the salmon problem, everyone is going to be hypersensitive with respect to this data. So maybe it'd be good if you could figure out when that might be, so that their expectations as to when they're going to receive the data and then be able to operate on it and participate in the decision-making process.
I believe in a few weeks we're talking about having a meeting with or call with the task force and start that conversation. So, yes, that is our intention.
Yeah, thanks.
Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Well, more disappointment, false hopes, broken promises. That's all we get about the abalone. If you want a new name for your commission, it should be the Commission of False Hopes and Broken Promises. We see a lack of integrity. There is no honor in what you're doing with the abalone issue. This is what discredits the commission. This is why you have lost any type of confidence. Your authority is completely being diminished time and time again because of your lack of any type of honor. The responsible spending, that's gone. Just squander the funds. Your facilitator at your abalone advisory committee, who's supposed to make everything cherry and juicy and make everything right, is going to fail. The end product of your advisory committee will be poo. They will spend all this time and money and come up with these arbitrary numbers that a high school child could have done in homework in one night. This is just despicable. It's foul and vile. And, you know, what verifies or validates or assures us of anything that's being done? Nothing, because nothing will be done. There will be no certainties, no absolutes, no guarantees. Who is responsible? Who's accountable? Who's liable? What type of compensation should we be entitled? We have said that the surveys are all done. You did a survey at the Farallons. All the surveys are done. Now we're waiting for this Chinese lady who hardly speaks English to come up with this arbitrary number. She said that reverse modeling is her best trick. She does that. That's how she acquires her numbers. As we know, figures lie and liars figure. And until the department and the Fish and Game Commission can be honest and truthful about the abalone situation, the outplanting of the diseased abalones, you have been responsible for the killing of complete species of abalones here in California. You don't want to learn the lessons that we've been taught. You're in denial. It is the most despicable thing that I've ever been involved with. I feel that my participation in these gatherings is tarnishing my spirit, that there is no worse thing than petty bureaucrats and bureaucratic double shuffle that we are getting out of the department because they don't want to be honest, do the right thing. They now admit that they don't have the skills, the ability, the training, the knowledge, or the experience to be able to fulfill their job duties. So we need to hire out. We need to have contractors do our job for us. And the other fact is that, look, you have a commission with no commissioners. We have two commissioners here. We have two that are absent. We have one that says that he wants to be a commissioner, but he's left for another party to go try and validate some type of monitoring process, which will never be done. It's a sham. It's a charade. This is fraud. It's a fallacy, and it's a farce.
Wrap it up, Paul. Thank you.
Yeah. And so no response. This demonstrates how wicked, sinister, and evil you are.
As soon as you give us something that's due a response, I'll give you a response. You may leave the podium now, or a warden's going to be on your butt. Right now, Paul.
So's your lack of integrity.
Yeah, my lack of integrity is going to be all over your butt. Warden, would you escort the gentleman outside, please? He's disrupting the meeting. Outside. He is disrupting the meeting, and he may remain outside for the rest of the meeting. Thank you. That's it, Paul. Outside now.
Should I move on? Item 13.
Yes, please move on.
Receipt of commission informational items. 13A, staff reports. Update on future legal representation. I would just like to let the commission know that, remind them that our Deputy Attorney General, Bill Cunningham.
Before we go any further, Paul, I want to put you on notice. The very next time you have an outburst like that in any one of our meetings, you're gone for the rest of the meeting and the rest of the days of the meeting. Do you understand me? You don't. Bye. Thank you.
Don't like the message, you attack the message.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're living in a very strange world, Paul.
Continue with item 13, receipt of commission informational items. 13A, staff reports. Update on future legal representation. I'd just like to let the commission know that commission staff is working on this issue. As you know, our longstanding Deputy Attorney General, Bill Cunningham, is in the process of retiring, and we will be working with the department or the Department of Justice on a new Deputy Attorney General. Right now, they have named Deborah Barnes, who will be at our next meeting and is going to work with us. We're also working with the department on other options for the future. So we will have more information on this in the future. Item 13A2, update on the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. In January, the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies held their midwinter meeting here in San Diego. And directors from all the western states and provinces, fish and game agencies, and commissioners from several of those states gathered for a three-day meeting to go over shared interests, shared items, shared goals. It was Commissioner Richard Rogers attended, and some commission staff and several department staff were there. It was a valuable meeting. One thing that came out of that was the summer meeting in July is going to be held in Rapid City, South Dakota. And then for the 09 midwinter meeting and 09 summer meeting, they're going to be held in California. California will be the host state. The department is the lead on that. They're working on that. Commission staff will assist. My understanding at this point, the January meeting of 09 is planned to be in the San Francisco area, and then the summer meeting in 09 in the Anaheim area. probably in August. Those dates aren't set yet.
Or Long Beach. Either Anaheim or Long Beach.
Same thing, right?
Right.
So we're moving forward with that, and I would encourage commissioners to attend these WAFWA meetings when available there. I think it's very useful to meet other commissioners from other states and kind of get an idea of the issues they're grappling with. And you'll find that, you know, not to toot our own horn, but California is on the cutting edge of a lot of issues that then spread out through the West. I don't know if, Richard, if you want to add anything about the WAFWA meeting.
No, it was a very interesting gathering of both the executive directors and the commissioners, and it was a remarkable exchange of information. The wonderful thing about it is that it's done in a very collegial atmosphere, so you're able to be offline and talk to people, not in a structured setting, such as a commission meeting or something of that nature. And I think the portions of the meeting that are non-structured, where you're standing out in the hallway having a cup of coffee with commissioners and executive directors from other states, the exchange is really quite good, quite intense. It's a wonderful thing to attend.
And then the one other thing I wanted to mention, there are report of commission informational items from the staff. The staff is continuing to work with a facilitator named Jim Nelson on working on commission organizational assessment and planning. And this is something we've been working on for about 7 months now. And we did hold a meeting with two commissioners and staff and some department staff, John McCammon and Sankey, to plan our full public organizational assessment meeting for the future. And we're getting close to that. We're going to be picking a date in the near future, and that will be publicly noticed, and that will be an effort with a facilitator, four commissioners, or five commissioners if we have a fifth one by then, to really roll up our sleeves and look at organizational assessment of commission operations and workload planning. And that is moving along. It's got a lot of momentum, and I think we're getting really close to having the full public meeting. That's it from the commission staff at this point. And we have no public speakers on this issue.
Yeah.
Moving on to item 14, subcommittee reports and recommendations. Marine Resources Committee. The Marine Resources Committee report we will put off till next month.
There is a Marine Resources Committee report, but the chair of the Marine Resources Committee is currently receiving the output of the Channel Islands Marine Sanctuary 5-year report, and it's up in Oxnard, California, and that's why he is not here. He is the best one to deliver that, so we will do that next meeting.
On the Al Tauscher Preserving Hunting and Sport Fishing Opportunities Advisory Committee, a meeting was held in January. Deputy Executive Director John Fisher can give a brief update on that.
Thanks. A very brief update. We met on January 10th at Yolo Wildlife Area. There were about 25 people there. We had a pretty full agenda, and it went very well. We're scheduled to meet again in March, and the hope is to meet up towards Williams and actually have a little recreational event as part of that. So we're hoping to meet on March 20th for that. So that in a nutshell is what we did.
Thank you. Item 15, receipt of federal agencies informational items. I saw Tony Morton here from NOAA Fisheries. There he is. No problem. Tony has a few comments or update for us. That would be great.
Good morning, commissioners. Congratulations on surviving yesterday. That was a long, tough day for you, I know. Since I was last with you, Dr. Bill Hogarth, who's in charge of NOAA Fisheries for the past 7 years, has retired, and his deputy, John Oliver, has been appointed to the position on an interim basis. Dr. Hogarth will continue in his role as chairman of the International Whaling Commission until that group holds its annual meeting this June. So He's joined Bill Cunningham in retirement, same effective date. NOAA Fisheries was recently petitioned to include all or parts of the ocean north of, or just off the coast of California, north of Point Conception to just south of the Washington-Oregon border as critical habitat for the endangered leatherback sea turtle. Critical habitat for leatherbacks is currently limited to an area around St. Croix and the Virgin Islands, but there is evidence that areas off the west coast provide important food sources for migrating turtles. So we are now gathering information about that and want to encourage anyone who believes they have information that might help us decide the most appropriate areas to potentially designate as critical habitat to send that information to us. The deadline for comments is February 26th, and for those of who may be interested in providing information, you can contact me at tony.morton@noaa.gov, and I'll be glad to provide you with the details on how to do that. And here comes another one, Commissioner Rogers. This past November 9th, the Cowlitz Indian Tribe in Washington State petitioned NOAA Fisheries to list a small fish known as oolacan as threatened or endangered. Oolacan is another species of smelt. It's anadromous, and for some reason it's also known as a hooligan. I'm not sure why that is. It grows to about 10 inches and has historically been an important source of food to salmon, marine mammals, and Native Americans. Its historical range appears to have extended from the Canadian border south to California, perhaps as far as the Sacramento River. So we at NOAA Fisheries have accepted the petition and are beginning the status review process, which means in about a year we'll be able to make a determination whether to propose that fish for listing as threatened or endangered. And finally,
it has been found in the Sacramento River?
Historically, it's been believed to have occurred that far south, so but in the process of doing this review, we'll
you're
gonna
find
attempt
out where,
to clarify
yeah,
that.
What its current range is, you're going to figure that out.
Right.
Yeah, great.
Exactly. And then finally, with regard to the proposal to engage in shallow set longline fishing for swordfish off the coast of California that Pete Dupuy addressed yesterday, NOAA Fisheries would like to see different fishing gears and techniques tested to determine if there's an economic way to catch swordfish without involving turtles or other species in the process. We believe that if we find something that works, our own fishing fleet would be able to supply swordfish to meet the U.S. demand, which is currently mostly provided by foreign vessels that often use non-discriminatory fishing methods. Mr. Dupuy has sought an exempted fishing permit for each of the past 2 years, but he's been frustrated in both attempts because of delays in completing the required environmental reviews. His first challenge was with us, with NOAA Fisheries, and then this year he got to experience the California Coastal Commission process. It's pretty clear now, at least to us at NOAA Fisheries, that the limited test fishing that Mr. Dupuy has been proposing would not result in any significant adverse effects to any non-target species because the number of hooks would be capped, there would be 100% observer coverage, and strict take limits on turtles or other species of concern would be immediately enforced. In the process, we'd hope to learn valuable information to help us confirm whether the modified fishing methods were feasible or not, and if so, we'd be in a position to encourage other nations to adopt those methods. So I don't know if he'll feel like trying for a third time or if some other fisherman may pick up the banner, but
I think
we're finally
will.
Ready with the clearances. That's all I have.
Actually, I have something that do you have any questions? I have something that is sort of opposing a question for you guys and maybe a request. Yesterday, during the halibut trawl fishery, we were exposed to some information that showed a dramatic bycatch differential between the California trawl waters and the federal trawl waters due to the difference in gear. I'm wondering what it would take to get the federal government to adopt gear restrictions that are more light touch. What would be the process to do that?
Well, that's something that you've got the right characters here in the audience, Don Hansen for one and Maria Vojkovic, so I guess I would address that challenge to them to bring up at the council process if they feel it's appropriate.
Yeah, because the bycatch in particular, differentials that we were presented through a scientific evaluation yesterday were profound, I think, is, what was it, 10 times, 100 times different in terms of, tonnage. I mean, that's remarkable.
Yeah, it really jumped out at you.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. Oh, you were here. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and so I think that's something that we'll I think want to pursue a bit. Not that we have jurisdiction, but I think it's probably the right thing to do. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Item number 16: receipt of legal counsel information. Deputy Attorney General Bill Cunningham.
Good morning, Mr. President, Ms. Vice President. Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General, Counsel for the California Fish and Game Commission. A very brief update, something that I've mentioned to you in the past. I wanted to let you know that we've been using a legal intern and my secretary over in the Office of the Attorney General to help assemble all of our files that I and my predecessor, Peter Vandernalen, have participated in, where our office has provided you legal counsel and a hearing officer for matters that have been heard by the commission in license and permit. And these go back to about 1999 when the powers were delegated to a hearing officer to conduct hearings on your behalf. We've been keeping organized files on your behalf as well, and we've done, at your request, an index of all of these files. I just counted them this morning. We have 333 to date that we've done on behalf of the commission, in which the commission has then gone forward and adopted a decision. And we are in the process of, we've indexed them chronologically. We've indexed them alphabetically, and we're also putting together an index on the subject matter of these hearings. And my understanding originally when this project was kind of put together to assemble all of these files, it's part of a necessary program in that we must keep these files indefinitely. But this is also a part of what I would suggest is an effort to organize these so that they can be used in the future by the commission. At some point in time, I am hopeful that the commission will have some thoughts on whether you want to adopt a fashion in which we will number all of these decisions, and then at some point in time, by resolution, perhaps consider a program in which we grant each of these decisions some precedential effect so that for the future, you, the commission, and whoever is serving as your hearing officer or delegee can make reference to these decisions in a fashion that is not designed to be shorthand, but at least you can say we are going to follow the same decision-making logic that we've followed in the following in the previous three decisions, and that this will be useful for you in both your ability to show the public what you do, but also to establish internally that what you do is consistent from day to day and from meeting to meeting. That was part of what you sought when you asked our office to help you as hearing officers, was some consistency in the program. And so I've put this all together. I have a draft of it. I'm going to leave with Mr. Fisher today, and we're going to keep working on this. And I look forward to your guidance on what you would like us to do with this and how you would like to proceed with this in the near future. Again, I think this is a good thing. I think at some point in time I would even suggest that something like this be made available even on the commission's website, so that people can see what you've done and that this is not just an occasional or random activity, that you have now a solid, on my own behalf, 6 years of doing this. And Mr. Vandernalen did this for several years beforehand. So you have a very extended history now of formal written decisions on license and permit matters. And so we're moving forward with this and await your direction.
Commissioner Gustafson, I think it's a marvelous idea. I mean, it's really a good idea, Bill, because all of us need guidance. History informs, and all of us need guidance, both on both the public who are coming to us and wondering how we might be interested, how we might rule on in a certain matter, and certainly ourselves, because we, as you say, we have so many of them. It's relatively easy to forget what you did a number of years ago, and it may have absolute precedence, and I think it's just a marvelous idea, and I also applaud the idea of putting it up on the website so that the public can have ready access to it so as to inform them.
I strongly support that as well. I hope you're not looking to the commission to decide on the numbering system that you would recommend or would recommend. But
he's asking the commission to just continue to pay the bills.
Well, part of what I think I would suggest is a somewhat less formal system, but something followed by the State Water Resources Control Board, as you may or may not be aware of. They are asked through the years to rule on a variety of water rights matters, and they adopt decisions. They actually number them, and they actually keep them in a published file, which is a little more formal than we want to be. But routinely, in the years that go by, people refer to decision 1491, and that becomes shorthand for a whole series of decisions and a whole logic chain that was followed in reaching those decisions. And I would suggest that at some point in time, we may want to go ahead, and whether we choose to do that with all of our decisions or not, we may want to at least discreetly select some and say, we want everybody to know about these decisions because these reflect the thinking and the tenor of the thinking of the commission on important resource issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, at first blush, one might think that the Water Resources Control Board decisions are far more complicated, or given the nature of water law in the Western United States, it is the oldest law, most contentious law, as we perhaps saw yesterday. But that's only at first blush. What we do is at least as complicated. It involves a myriad, just a huge broad spectrum of different types of endeavors, and it would be very, very easy for the public to be misled, and ourselves to be misled with respect to previous decisions. I think it's a great idea to catalog it. I think it's a great idea to be able to access it much the same way, and to be able to internally refer to decision 14-67B, because we deal with things that are so disparate. Water law has a tendency to, pardon the expression, flow in a certain direction, but ours is, we're all over the map, and I think that'd be a great idea.
Mr. Cunningham, I have one other comment I wanted to bring up. Based on some issues that we've been talking about on the permits, I wanted to ask staff to look into an issue that concerns me, that once we have a conviction, that we're able to immediately suspend a license, and what that would take for that to be an automatic suspension, and give us a report on that. I'm concerned that a lot of time goes by between a conviction and then the commission acting on it. In the meantime, people that have been convicted are still fishing. They're still out there doing things. And
that goes back to my comment yesterday that justice delayed is justice denied.
Right.
What could we do?
The point is very well taken, and I know
I
it's
agree.
Been a point of serious concern for both this commission and its predecessors over the years. And I have two suggestions. One, if we were going to try to implement the, unfortunately, the time is upon us immediately. One would be to see if the legislature would also be willing to help us out and clarify in the California Fish and Game Code within the provisions that talk about our ability to use convictions to take license action, to go ahead and put in place an additional piece of language that says upon conviction there is an ability also for the commission to immediately suspend a fishing permit or license or entitlement with the understanding that there would then be subsequently granted an opportunity for hearing for further consideration on the matter. And that is not uncommon. There are other places, as you're familiar with, for example, when driver's licenses are seized and driving privileges are suspended during an accident event, subsequent hearings are then provided, so due process is fulfilled, but there is an ability to immediately take somebody off the road. So we could look to legislative aid in this matter. Again, as I think you heard from Director McCammon, the window on that is less than a couple of days practically, and therefore almost impossible. I can also look into and work with my successor for the commission and with department counsel into the possibility that the commission may be able to adopt some regulation, perhaps in Section 746 of Title 14, which is our administrative hearings process and permitting process, in which we can also look for some relief and see if we can perhaps ourselves, through regulation, generate that relief without the necessity for going forward with legislative relief as well.
I think it's well advised. That's a very, very good suggestion. I think one of the problems enforcement has is that disconnect between the event and the punishment. And we have some people out there who are not only commercializing California's wildlife, but are, even if they're not doing that, they're operating in complete disregard with the rules and regulations governing the take. And that is an extraordinary problem, and I think some of them might even be, we've had these discussions before, taking advantage of that time disconnect and knowing that it may or may not be coming, and it might be a couple of years. And that's not a good situation, because we are dealing with lots of critters out there who are whose numbers are minimal.
If I might remind the commissioners, curiously, the legislature understands this problem in some contexts. As you may recall, in a decision we just very recently addressed, just in a matter of the last month or so, the director and his staff have an ability, when certain kinds of violations take place within wildlife areas or state-managed areas, to immediately terminate privileges, with then a subsequent hearing granted for further consideration. So due process takes place, but it does follow an immediate ability to terminate somebody's access to facilities when there is good cause. So that there are at least examples of this that we could either follow or at least use to create our own relief as well.
So we'll so staff will look into this, and we'll look at the potential remedies we have. Great. Thank you.
Just a moment, please.
Commissioners, apparently there's a little bit of an additional update by the department on halibut, federal halibut, that they feel is important. If we could,
yeah, excuse me for this, commissioners, but based on your discussion with our federal representative here, we wanted to clarify the record to provide you a little bit more information on what authority you actually do have with federal halibut, and Maria Vojkovic will give you a kind of a teaser for that.
Thanks.
Far away, Maria.
Well, if you recall, the halibut regulation was in the hands of the legislature, and they've recently passed that authority over to you to regulate halibut. At the same time, they also instituted a halibut permit, so that to land halibut in the state of California, they have to have a permit now. So the authority rests with you to manage the halibut fleet. The way this works in federal waters is that if the federal government does not have a fisheries management plan for a species, then the commission or the department has the authority out to 200 miles. And now that we have a permit that's required to land fish, the requirements of that permit, you are in total control of that.
It's very interesting, Maria.
So I would suggest that we bring this whole picture along with our federal partners on this picture to the MRC.
Perfect.
And build that discussion within there and clarify what really we can do or what we can't do or who can do what. And that's what my suggestion would be.
That's perfect venue. Thank you. That's a marvelous suggestion, and thank you for that bit of illumination.
Thank you, Maria, for doing that on the fly.
Shows what happens when you know your subject.
That takes us to item 17, new business. This is an opportunity if the commissioners have any new business they'd like to have on a future agenda.
I don't know if we need to have it on a future agenda. I had floated the idea with a number of parties regarding an annual, beginning the process of having an annual commission dinner. And, you know, really focusing, working with our county commissions as well as our legislators to invite them to present some awards, especially the Warden of the Year award, to be presented to an audience that I think would really benefit from understanding what we're doing, what the department's doing, and promoting the efforts of the department as well as the commission. So I'd like to direct staff to continue working on that with the rest of the commission's support. Richard?
Well, I know you have my support. You and I have discussed this, and I suspect Commissioner Sutton would be delighted, and Commissioner Kellogg, of course, would be delighted to embrace this idea. I think it's a terrific idea, because there are a lot of people out there who do wonderful work in the work that we're responsible for, who, like, for example, county commissions and local district attorneys and things of this nature, where they're the pointy end of the stick. And it's wonderful. It's a great idea.
Well, I'd like to see if we could pull it off this spring sometime. So I know that's a pretty tight timeline, but
I think we need to think about it, and the sooner the better.
Okay.
Yeah, my understanding is the Wardens Association has said that.
Yes, I'm sorry. I should have shared that. The Wardens Association is happy to work with us to allow the funding to be used, you know, the checks to go through them, and to work with us on putting this together. So we're very happy about that.
It's really a wonderful suggestion. Thank you, Cindy. That's great.
And we actually have a model from one of our sister commissions. Arizona has been doing this for a number of years, and my understanding is very successful. And through some relationships I've come to make through the WAFWA, I'll be talking to the Arizona Commission and their staff about some tips on how to really pull this off.
Also, I think it is the case that not only in the legislature but also in the administration, but obviously more particularly in the legislature, because there's certainly more of them, there are some people out there, some men and women who are doing elected officials who are doing marvelous work and really helping protect the resources of the state of California, and they need the same sort of acclimation. So. John?
That moves us along to item 18. Mr. Cunningham, this would be announcement of results from executive session that we held yesterday.
Thank you. Again, Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General. I wanted to announce that the commission met in executive session yesterday during its lunch hour. This executive session is conducted behind closed doors pursuant to Government Code Section 11-126. Which allows you to meet with your legal counsel to discuss matters in litigation, also to discuss and deliberate matters involving license and permits and proposed decisions. I want to indicate that we discussed one item on the license and permits. It has to do with a Mr. Powers, and the action taken on that as of yesterday's meeting was direction to your hearing officer and to your staff to reschedule that for an additional hearing to receive additional testimony to augment the record before a decision was to be made. So following that direction, we will be notifying Mr. Powers that an additional hearing will be scheduled to receive additional testimony, take additional evidence, and provide a new and additional proposed decision to the commission. And that's all I have on that meeting.
Thank you, Bill.
Item 19, receipt of department proposals for tag quota changes, clarifications, and urgency changes for the 2008-2009 mammal hunting regulations and request to publish notice of commission intent to make tag quota changes, clarifications, and urgency changes. Eric Loft.
Good morning, Commissioners. Eric Loft with the Wildlife Branch in the department. And today we're here to basically introduce the mammal hunting regulations, perhaps for the 101st time. So I did do a little PowerPoint in honor of that. Commissioners, as you know, and maybe some of the folks don't know, this is the off year for major regulation changes unless there's an emergency condition for wildlife. And the department returns to you every year with quota numbers as recommendations for you to consider. And what we're doing right now in February is coming back to you with a range of numbers for most of our large mammal big game hunting opportunities until our final winter surveys are completed for the various big game species. And of the sections that we have, sections 360, ABC, and this will go real quick, for deer hunting, for general deer hunting in the A, B, C, and D zones, for archery, and also for the X zones. What we're coming to you with now, and actually I threw the pictures in at the last moment last night, just to demonstrate that, you know, you do deal with a diverse bit of animals, and some of them do have fur, and these are the charismatic megafauna that people talk about and have enjoyed for 100 years, and so not nearly as controversial as the things that you've dealt with over the past 24 hours, certainly, but that's just to get our plug in. So we're going to provide a range of harvest levels for you to consider, and we'll develop our final recommendation again after the surveys are completed. The other additional minor change that we would make is to accommodate some of the military operations at Fort Hunter Liggett, where we're going to modify our season dates a bit to accommodate their base operations. 362 is bighorn sheep. Same thing. We are conducting surveys. They aren't totally completed yet, but we will provide a range of harvest levels for you to consider. And there will likely be sheep hunts in seven zones. Section 363, the neat animal, the pronghorn antelope, of course. And again, the same thing, just minor changes in terms of quota numbers. We'll see how the how pronghorn, in particular mule deer, have fared this winter with the heavy snows, and we'll get some numbers for that. And come back to that, come back to you next month or in April with the final numbers. 364 is elk hunting, and we're going to provide a range of harvest levels for you to consider. Modify again for some of the elk hunts at Fort Hunter Liggett to accommodate their base operations. There's a couple of clarifications that are being proposed in terms of distinguishing bull elk from antlerless elk and other minor changes that are being done for clarity and consistency. And then lastly, this actually is a proposal from enforcement, section 712. This deals with chronic wasting disease. The map here shows states that have been affected by chronic wasting disease, and of course we want to keep it out of California, so the enforcement folks have recommended some additional regulatory change to the existing language to prevent hunters from bringing in their killed elk and or deer from out of state into California and reduce the potential for transmission of CWD into California, and that'll be on there. And actually, that's all. This is unrelated to this charismatic microfauna here, but this is
that a bull elk? What is that?
This is on your consent calendar, and I throw this up here in case someone doesn't know what a pica is.
Okay.
It's not a plant, and it's not a fish. So
that is appreciated, though, because too often, and maybe my memory is blank, but I don't know if we saw a photo of a live longfin smelt yesterday. It would be nice to see photos of everything we're dealing with.
And, John, just to give you here's a critter that, you know, you throw these big game, and then you show this little thing that lives at subalpine levels year-round and makes it pretty amazing critter.
Yeah,
I have seen them. I love their whistle. But actually, aren't those like the size of a woolly mammoth? Wait a minute. Now, how big are those guys? They used to be that big. Yeah, they used to be that big. Thank you, Eric.
It's like one of those Japanese cartoon characters, doesn't it?
Now we have no speaker public speaker requests on this item. I want to remind the commissioners that yesterday the full commission, the quorum, voted to authorize the two of you today as a subcommittee to give direction. We don't need an official motion and vote from you on this, but we could use direction to go to notice. Publish notice on this commission intent with the department's recommendations.
Commissioner Gustin?
Sure.
Yes.
I agree with that.
As well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go to
number 20. Request to publish notice of commission intent to amend section 27.80, title 14, related to ocean salmon sport fishing. My understanding is Maria Vojkovic, who's been very busy this morning, will... And smiling from ear to ear, which is nice, because we're almost done, right?
Yes. Thank you. Maria Vojkovic with the Marine Region. We're requesting to go to notice for the salmon regulations in the ocean. However, there's a couple of things I'd like to mention. The package that was put together was for this notice was put together much more earlier than the information we got about salmon. And the intent was to provide the range of alternatives from no fishing to the kind of fishing season that we had this past year. And so we're going to have to look at that package again to make sure that that's truly what's available for you to make a decision on. Also, because of the Central Valley issue with the stocks, there may be a need to also restrict fishing in the rivers. And that is not part of the package currently. It may come as another package, but I'm just giving you a heads up that this may be more broad than just ocean fishing for the Central Valley stocks. And then relative to the Klamath, if you recall, each year we talk about allocations to the in-river fishery and the negotiations that go on during the process of establishing a range of alternatives. And I just wanted to verify with you that the guidance you've given in the past relative to in-river allocations, that I propose to take that guidance that you've given us in the past to the negotiations rather than having you choose a specific percentage allocation, because we know the realities of the numbers and allocations, decisions that are, or negotiations that are done within the council process. So I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to use that guidance from the past in where we go forward.
Thank you.
And you'll get more information at certainly at the for the April meeting.
Right, I'm sure we will. We just have to approve going to notice. So we have that approval? There's no public speakers.
Right. Do I need to make motions?
No, I don't think so.
Just number 20, we just need a...
This is on 20. We just need
a general direction from the two of you as a subcommittee.
To absolutely. Go
and you have that. 21 was somewhat in...
We actually have a presentation on item 21. Request to publish notice of commission intent to amend subsection B 91.1 of section 7.50, title 14, related to Klamath River sport fishing regulations. We have Larry Hansen, senior fisheries biologist out of Region 1.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Larry Hansen. As John mentioned, I'm a senior biology supervisor out of the Northern Region. I had basically a fairly extensive presentation prepared for you this morning. Maria has really covered a lot of the information, so in the interest of expediency, I'm going to go kind of to the pertinent points and not repeat what's already been said in the
On Fridays with the commission, pertinent points are delightful.
Well, that's good. I'm here to help and serve you there. So, anyway, as was mentioned earlier, preliminary population estimates have been calculated for the 2007 Klamath River Fall Run Chinook. The good news, again, is that for the first time in 4 years, we have met the conservation objective, or the spawning floor, however you wish to phrase it, and that is 35,000 adult fish in the basin, in the entire basin. So based on that, these preliminary numbers have been scrutinized by a multidiscipline review panel, and they've been finalized. That meeting took place this week. That was an age composition meeting, and those numbers are now going to be provided to a technical modeling team of the PFMC. And Maria has already gone through the process and provided you a slide on how that process with the TMC parallels the commission meeting process as well. So having said that, I'm going to go ahead and skip forward to the proposed changes that we are presenting to you today for notice. First of all, I want to say a couple of things. That the very first step in the process of developing these proposed changes was to have the basin enforcement staff meet with myself and my staff, so that we had, basically, we did not want to be proposing anything that would be in any kind of a contradiction to enforcement and the department's ability to enforce these regulations. Also, these proposed changes have been presented to several groups already. The first group that it was presented to on January 9th was the Trinity Management Council, which is a multiple discipline group composed of the Bureau of Reclamation, Hoopa Valley Tribe, Yurok Tribe, NOAA, Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Trinity County. Also, presentations are scheduled to be presented to the other, informational meetings for the other three counties affected by these regulation changes are scheduled in the following weeks. Unfortunately, we've had a series of really violent weather systems. Everything that was scheduled for the month of January was essentially canceled due to snowfall, so we got sort of backlogged in the entire process. So the first of the proposed changes we have is that daily bag limits, possession limits, open seasons for all fisheries in the basin will be presented in a tabular format this year. And the beauty of that is that the regulations will correspond, and the lettering and the numbering of the regulations will correspond directly to a map that's provided in the supplemental regulation booklet. So this is intended to make the regulations just a little bit less confusing to the angling public. We receive lots of comments every year about that they need a PhD or a law degree in order to read these regulations, and this is an effort to try and, you know, nip that at the bud and make it a little easier for the angler to understand.
A little easier, so then instead of a PhD, they'll just need a master's?
Right. Well, actually, a lot easier. It's nice because, again, you can look at the rather than looking at the verbiage of the regulation, it's all basically presented tabularly. You look at where you're fishing, you follow the line across, you can see when it's open, what the daily in bag possession limits is.
That is a very, very good idea. With all due respect to legal counsel and all, it is very difficult for the lay people to, myself included, to figure out what you can do and where you can do it. I applaud your efforts.
Well, the reality is it's not a novel idea. We've sort of come in on the back of the heels of many other states that have gone this way. Quite a large change here is that we would like the commission to differentiate between fall run Chinook salmon and spring run Chinook salmon. We have two races of salmon in the basin, and one is an allocated stock and one is not. Now, previous to this year, the spring run bag and possession limits were set by a means of a default in the regulation. So it's like, except for this and this, it defaults back to the spring management. As a direct request from enforcement, we've asked that the spring run be differentiated from the fall run by calendar dates, which correspond to January 1 through August 14th on the Klamath River, and January 1 through August 31st on the Trinity River, wherein the regulations would switch over to fall run, which is based on allocations as it has been in the past that are developed by the PFMC. A bit of good news again is we are proposing for your consideration an increase in the daily bag limit and possession limit of steelhead on the main stem Trinity River, and this is due to huge returns of steelhead, of hatchery steelhead. There's no retention of wild fish in the basin, period, on steelhead. But we've had extremely large returns over the last 3 years. Last year in particular was a banner year. This year appears to be even larger. The bag limit has been set at one fish a day, one fish in possession. We've provided you a range of harvest levels and possession limits to consider, and we feel that this is a really good win-win situation for the economies of these counties as well. Another proposed change in the regulations for your consideration is the alignment of South Fork Trinity River angling seasons. The way they're set up right now, they're pretty much disjointed. There are three sections within the South Fork Trinity River in the regulations right now. Two are open from the fourth Saturday in May through March 31st. One is open from November 1 to March 31st. The fishery is intended to provide a catch-and-release opportunity to anglers for adult fall and winter run steelhead. Those fish do not reside in the river from the fourth Saturday in May through October 31. What does reside in the river during that period of time are two highly sensitive species, spring run Chinook and summer steelhead. We feel that basically this is a possible loophole in the regulation that would allow folks to go in and fish on top of these highly sensitive stocks during periods of extremely low surface flows and elevated water temperatures, thereby causing, even if these fish are released, the potential for mortality is very high. And lastly, we would like to propose for your consideration, removing brown trout regulations from all rivers and streams in the Klamath Basin other than the main stem Trinity River. This was brought in several years ago, providing more angling opportunity. The reality is that these brown trout are principally distributed throughout the Trinity River system. And again, the loophole is if I were to say I was fishing for brown trout on top of some fairly sensitive stocks in a tributary or stream where these brown trout don't principally reside, I would be legally allowed to fish those fisheries, causing harm. So that's essentially a wrap-up of all the changes. If you have any questions.
Any questions? So we would approve going to notice. I have a question for you, actually. Is there any connectivity between this issue and the health of the Chinook and the Sacramento, in the sense that here, even though they're hatchery raised, they are anadromous and they're out there somewhere, probably in relatively the same, I don't know this, and I'm not sure if anyone does, but relatively the same places that the salmon are, and yet at the Klamath we're experiencing record returns. Trinity, excuse me.
Record returns on steelhead.
That's what I mean.
Okay.
And steelhead do that. Well, they're out there in the same place, which then leads one to believe that, yes, there are ocean influences. Certainly we understand the difference in upwelling. It's been somewhat profound over the last couple of years. But in that location, it doesn't seem to affect the return.
There's a lot of thought right now that steelhead occupy different areas of the ocean than salmon, whereas salmon are more of a coastally oriented species. The steelhead, there's been some preliminary data indicating that they're more of a oceanic pelagic species.
More pelagic.
When they're out at sea.
Well, that might explain the difference. But that's something, you know, that we ought to, well, of course, I know you are. So, anyway. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. We don't have any public speakers. Are you walking to the podium, Sankey? You want to say something? Oh, just checking. All right. We could use commission direction on this one also.
We did. You had it.
To public notice. We did. You got it. Boy, those are quick. That brings us to item 22, request to publish notice of commission intent to amend Title 14 CCR related to certification of non-lead ammunition and list of certified non-lead ammunition pursuant to provisions of AB 821. Deputy Director Sankey Master.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is the last piece of implementing the AB 821 legislation, which is essentially the certification, ammunition certification provision of that piece. And what you have before you is an eyesore that whose intent is to facilitate the changes you adopted earlier on 353 and 475 on defining projectiles, the minimum or the maximum content of lead in the projectiles, possession of lead ammunition, etc., for the previous items. Specifically, this certification process establishes a public process by which you have an option in the regulation or the proposal that either the commission or the department shall certify this list of centerfire rifle and pistol ammunition and projectiles. This includes a process for identifying the type of information the manufacturer will need to supply for certification. It also establishes that certified ammunition and projectiles will be placed on a public list to facilitate compliance. And it also has a provision for removing projectiles and ammunition in case of an error or change in manufacturing. And, of course, the ultimate purpose of this certification is to make sure that no lead in hunters' bullets are exposed to condors as secondary lead poisoning. There are some provisions in this proposal that you should be aware of. The original NAVA bill did not identified only ammunition, and of course you as commissioners know that ammunition is made up of components. The only piece of that ammunition that matters really in terms of secondary poisoning is the projectile itself. So the certification focuses on the projectile, not the ammunition per se. Statute also focuses on center fire, and as you know, we have other big game hunting done with muzzleloaders and shotguns that aren't considered center fire rifle and pistol. So we're bringing those into the certification. And I think that's pretty much it. Oh, and that this certification process needs to be put in place as soon as possible, of course, because on July 1st, 2008, if we don't have any certified ammunition, there will be no hunting in zones D7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 13, and Southern A Zone. So if you have any questions, by all means ask. We're ready to help answer any questions you might have.
Any questions?
No, no questions.
I think we have some public speakers. We do not. Okay. So we approve going to notice?
Yes.
We do?
Yep.
Great.
So go.
That moves us to, we do have two cards for public speakers on the consent calendar. The consent calendar was passed by the commission yesterday. It was on our agenda for today, but as our agendas always state that the items can be heard on either day in order pursuant to the determination of the commission president. So we did vote that through yesterday with a quorum, but we do have two folks that would like to comment. So starting with William Everett.
Craig Harrison was going to go first, then Bill Everett. Well, we're both with representing the Endangered Species Recovery Council.
Before you speak, may I apologize to those who were held over? Well, you probably thought you were going to get it here today.
Yeah, anyway. We weren't held over. We came today.
So. But it's very difficult for us to operate without a quorum. We were forced into that situation yesterday, given one of our commissioners had to receive testimony from the Channel Islands Marine Sanctuary. And he's doing the state's business, but he's doing it elsewhere. And so we had to do that. And I'm very sorry to disrupt and to do that off. But as John says, we always try to warn everyone that we can move things around, and we sometimes have to. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Craig Harrison. I represent the Endangered Species Recovery Council, and I'm speaking to the department report on the petition to delist the brown pelican. I know you can't act on the actual regulation for delisting at this meeting because of CEQA compliance issues, but I didn't want to let this report go unremarked. The department is recommending that this species be delisted. And by the way, I think everyone knows what a pelican looks like, but I have here from spring of 2006, Endangered Species Act, a success story with the brown pelican on the cover. This is put out by the American Bird Conservancy, the only national organization directed only toward conservation of birds. They are strongly behind this, as well as many other environmental groups. You will be sometime this year on the verge of making a historic decision because this commission has never delisted a species in its history since California's had CESA or its predecessor back to 1970. There's been a couple of instances where fish have been delisted because they went extinct. That's not the kind of story we want to hear about. There are several instances where plants have been delisted because it was decided the taxonomy was incorrect and they were really part of a larger range of a common species. The holdup right now is the CEQA issue, and I just want to briefly go over my history of my involvement and my organization's involvement in this. The idea of getting the federal and state government to delist this species has been bandied about among serious conservation biologists for at least 10 years. We got started on preparing these petitions 2.5 years ago, and they were initially submitted simultaneously to the Fish and Wildlife Service and to the Fish and Game Commission in December of 2005. That's now 26 months ago. Neither process is completely done. The Fish and Wildlife Service issued a 5-year status review last March and decided that they were recommending delisting. This morning, I understand that the Secretary of Interior and the Governor of Louisiana jointly announced in Louisiana that they are officially proposing delisting on the federal for the federal species, so that'll probably be in the Federal Register in another week or two. Their process will take, that will take, you know, further period of time. On the California side, Our initial petition was returned to us as not being on the correct form. Fortunately, Dr. David Ainley, who's not here today, spent a lot of time and effort getting into the form that the commission would accept. You decided over a year ago that it met the basic criteria, and you went through the one-year status review, and the report that you have received has confirmed what we've been saying, that the species has recovered. The CEQA issue has been the biggest bone of contention for us. I don't know how much the commissioners have been involved in this, but there is a Supreme Court case, the Mountain Lion Foundation case, which requires CEQA compliance. We understand that. And the issue has been who has to prepare this. Our view as petitioners, we are a biological conservation organization. We have no commercial interest in this whatsoever. We think of ourselves as the conscience of the conservation community, that species that are listed should really be endangered so that resources for endangered species will be spent on species that are truly endangered. To prepare an environmental impact report would cost about $100,000. That was beyond our capability. We have reached an agreement, at least a tentative agreement, several months ago with counsel for Cal Fish and Game and the Resources Agency that we can proceed with a negative declaration. We are able to proceed to prepare that on a pro bono basis. Everybody involved in this is pro bono. And that has just this week been submitted to the attorneys at Cal Fish and Game. We are hopeful that they will not raise any unnecessary obstacles to getting that finalized and out for public review, and I ask you, commissioners, to kind of sit on that and watch that a little bit. We want to get this done. And so I think we have a very positive story today. When this is all said and done, I am hoping that you might entertain some thoughts from us as far as how you might make this process easier. You cannot expect pro bono people to be doing the state's work over and over again. There's a lot of species that probably should be delisted. It may take some legislative work, but I would be happy. We want to get this one done, but afterwards I think you ought to be thinking about the bigger picture of how to resolve this better in the future.
Commissioner. Okay.
Nodding in agreement.
As am I. I think the procedure to delist is arcane.
Yes,
and almost ridiculously complicated.
Yes.
And Byzantine. What we would love to do, I think, speaking to the head Byzantonian,
he's the acting Byzantonian. I understand.
The commission would really love to do whatever it can to facilitate either legislative help in this regard. It is the case that proper delisting and ease of delisting is essential to validate the process of listing. Because otherwise, then people will not, they'll see a rational process and they'll not fight the listing process the same as they do now, because they think that once something's on there, it's gone forever. And so I think that's something very important for us to keep in mind, and whatever help we need from the legislature, I'm sure they'll be delighted to give it.
Well, the primary area of help is to designate funding for California Endangered Species Act specific activities, which we have no designated funding for.
Right.
So that's a people would call it an unfunded mandate. It's basically undesignated as to its source of funding. That's why we use a lot of general fund in that area, to the degree we have general fund availability, and that is declining year to year, as you know. So this is a big issue. It's a concern. We're simultaneously going through an issue with the Siskiyou Mountain Salamander that you'll recollect having heard about quite a bit. And it's a concern. I've met with some of their representatives to try and identify mechanisms for getting this accomplished, given the limited resources we have. But clearly, our attorneys view this as a project under CESA, and we have to go through that process.
Indeed, so we do. But the extent to which anything the commission can do to facilitate that, we certainly would be delighted to do so, including talking to legislators. Relying on pro bono work from the public to delist something that was done by the governmental entities is just unacceptable in my mind. So,
and the problem you have, I mean, we were viewed, frankly, by many people with suspicion. What are you guys really up to? What's your real commercial advantage? We don't have one. If we are here with a commercial advantage, or we went out to commercial people to help us on that, then we get triply suspicious. So it's just not a good situation.
Isn't it delightful to be asked about commercial advantage when the issue is biology?
Yes.
Has nothing to do with commercial advantage.
You know, is there any way in the listing process that the goals for recovery are stated so that once they're reached, you don't go through this complicated process? In other words, you're going through doing all the research. You have established some sort of thresholds by which you think this is now an endangered species, and if their goals were set right then, perhaps it can be an easier document
It may be a legal issue, whether that satisfies the Mountain Lion Federation case. And frankly, speaking to some national experts in this area, don't be so sure that CEQA won't be invoked in listing processes at some point if you don't resolve the CEQA issue, because there are some serious concerns that the proposals of listing a species can raise CEQA concerns because people who are on their own managing their land say, wait a minute, if this is going to become endangered, you can tell me what to do. I'm no longer doing these voluntary things. And is that a fair argument on an environmental problem? I think it is. So the CEQA issue is serious, and I think you ought to go for a categorical exemption on that, is my opinion.
But we
want to get the pelican issue done now. I don't want to.
It's not complicated any further. But Sankey?
In fact, CEQA is required on all our listing petitions and is done currently. So we're way past that stage.
I'm sorry. I was involved in the Xanthus mural listing, and there was no CEQA document prepared.
I'm saying now we do CEQA on all of them now. It's been a process of evolution. So all our listing petitions.
So a petitioner, so you would view the Center for Biological Diversity petitioning you to list a species, you would tell them to spend $100,000 on an EIR?
Yes. And what happens is the petition itself doesn't require CEQA, but the regulation to add it to the list requires CEQA.
Oh, no, that's the issue we have with delisting.
Right,
correct.
And that's why CEQA is triggered on an action on regulation, essentially. The listing petition itself doesn't. But the good news about the listing is generally all the work is done through the status review. So doing the CEQA document is already pretty much done by the time you get to the point of accepting it for candidacy or not.
Well, we viewed that was what our petition should have taken care of everything on the CEQA issue as well, but that's not what the department was telling us for the last year.
No, there were different issues. You're mixing issues. One of the problems is we've never done one of these, as has been well pointed out. So the council had to wrestle with what's actually required. The other hiccup with brown pelican from a completely effect point of view is they're on the fully protected list. So once you delist them, they're still fully protected. And actually the provisions under fully protected are much more stringent than under CESA. So we were wrestling with, it's unique, it's not unique to pelicans, includes several others. As you will know, peregrine falcon is going to be coming before you. It's also fully protected. So we're still legally wrestling with this issue of those species that are both listed under CESA and fully protected. They're a little unusual.
Well, to net it out.
Cutting it easier, not harder.
Yes, cutting to the chase, we need to do absolutely everything we can to make it easier. And as far as the commission is concerned, you know, we really would love to see that happen. And anything we can do to aid that, we would love to do.
And the bald eagle will be coming down the road from somebody. But having done one of these, I don't intend to do another one, given how much work it is. So I'll let Bill Everett speak.
Mr. President, if I might.
Please.
The one last problem I know the department is familiar with in trying to delist and deal with CEQA is to remember that when the Supreme Court said we had to use CEQA in a delisting, it wasn't because of the successful recovery of the species in question. It was because the courts were concerned that other species had benefited from the listing process. And the question was the impacts on those other species by delisting. So that even if we set quotas and set recovery strategies for the species at issue, nowhere do we ever really think about everything else that benefits from our listing of a species. And the courts have said we've got to think about that when we delist, because all of those related species in the same habitats are now going to be exposed.
Does the term ecosystem ring a bell?
Ecosystem management. Yes, sir.
Thanks for the education there, Mr. Cunningham.
Commissioners, my name is William Everett. I'm president of the Endangered Species Recovery Council. We are the nonprofit organization that prepared and submitted the petition to delist the California brown pelican. And in particular, Commissioner Rogers, I'd like to say thank you for your comments on this because we're on exactly the same page. We would like to see the process altered to make this a little bit easier than it has been. For the record, I'd like to say...
We thought we would include the Coastal Commission in this, if that's all right.
Good luck on that one.
I think they could make it simpler, couldn't they?
Oh, boy. You had the Coastal Commission hearing a couple of days ago down here. It was just an absolute...
My condolences.
Yeah, exactly. For the record, I would like to point out that our organization had absolutely nothing to do with the recovery of the California brown pelican. And frankly, neither did the California Department of Fish and Game. But for 2.5 years, all we've been asking is that the state to recognize that since the ban on DDT dumping, that the pelican has essentially recovered itself. It's a tremendous story. And indeed, more than 20 years ago, the Pacific Seabird Group, which is the leading scientific organization focusing on seabird conservation and research, recommended delisting of the species. 20 years ago, the primary scientific organization felt that this was warranted. It's been a really remarkable two and a half year journey for us since we petitioned to delist the pelican. And much to our amazement, we've consistently encountered resistance, roadblocks, bureaucratic hurdles, unwarranted delays, excuses, and denials on the part of Fish and Game for what virtually every involved conservation organization, Audubon Society, Environmental Defense Fund, American Bird Conservancy, sees as a long overdue no-brainer. And unfortunately, this experience has left me rather cynical regarding what ought to be a great victory and validation of the State Endangered Species Act. Still, I'm hopeful that in the very near future, I'll see the same Fish and Game officials in front of cameras congratulating each other on a job well done. Nevertheless, what matters in the end is that the public will see that the endangered species protections might actually have some value and work. And I just simply would like to thank your commission for your efforts to support this important initiative. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
That wraps up public comment for today. Our next item is item 35, announcement of future meetings.
You know, actually, let's stay on that other point just for a second, if this is appropriate, if you would think this is appropriate.
Sure.
Maybe it would be a good idea for us to entertain a presentation by the department at some point in time. In the next meeting or two or three, whenever we could get this, to talk about the issues that these gentlemen have been raising in a formal setting with the rest of our commissioners so that we can understand what is now having experienced your first iteration learning curve, sort of like a lessons learned, and like what we're doing with BRTF, we have been doing there, because this is the first time, and I will give you that grace of having it the first time. I don't think that there are, you know, strange people, you know, hiding within the department who don't want this and therefore are trying to spanner the process. I don't think so. I suspect that what it is a brand new event and we're having to learn about it. But let's go through a little bit of the lessons learned, because the gentleman is correct. This may be the first time, but there are going to hopefully be others. And by peregrine, for example, there are a bunch of them, and I think it would be a great idea if we could sort of come up with protocols or things or where we know the hard points are and discuss them and see if we can all help one another get past that. And anything we can do to help, we would certainly be delighted to do so. So maybe, what do you think, Sankey, in a month or two, we could do a sort of a lessons learned, if we will, running off of this as an example?
Yeah, because of the timing of documents that have to be before you for the March meeting, April would be the soonest.
Fine. But let's maybe May. I mean, I'm not suggesting that we, you know.
Okay, so it's, we can talk about resources available to us. One of our problems is I have literally one individual doing all this
stuff.
Indeed.
I'm not trying to put another unfunded mandate on you from the commission. What I'm trying to do is have us all focus on a process that you've just gone through, so it's nice and fresh in everyone's memory and all the staffers' memory, that we're going to have to visit again and again right. and again and again, starting from now on, because actually there are some great success stories out there, some of which these gentlemen had something to do with and some they didn't. So I think it's a great idea. And I think it invigorates the conservation community and those who care about all these critters because then they see the end result.
Yeah, I think it's a good – well, I agree with you completely. The department is very much interested in supporting these efforts, and I think what we can do is lay out the process as we understand it, the criteria that we use when we look at these things and standards that we feel need to be met, and then we can talk about ways to getting there, greasing the skids, if you
yeah,
will.
Part of it may simply be communications with those who are right. who need to understand what the game is that constricts us
right.
and the things that we need to do.
Kind of information we expect on those kind of things.
Exactly.
So we can bring that kind of a overview to you based on lessons learned and maybe identify some bottlenecks that we need to address. And
perfect.
Maybe the commission can help us deal with those.
Well, because I think actually we dramatically improved the process of the through the BRTF with the MLPA process. I think we dramatically improved the second iteration, and this is just a lessons learned thing. I mean, you guys hadn't gone through that before, and I'll give you that. You know, this is a learning curve. Thank you.
Do you think it makes sense to also to potentially have this as a special meeting in Sacramento, in which we can invite some of the legislative staff to attend and hear these issues? I mean, if we want to really get change to occur, I think they need to hear what needs to be changed.
You know, I'm sorry. I think it's a grand suggestion. I'm sorry some of the larger environmental groups who were here yesterday are not here today, mm-hmm. Who could have observed this and made commentary about that. I think you're absolutely right. I think that would be a marvelous way to raise the consciousness
I mean, you
of people.
You hear where we're at, and I think we're on the same page in helping this process, but we're going to need some tools in place. The department's going to need tools in place in order to really make substantive
It's going to take
change.
Interagency cooperation yeah. And probably
And it's a great story, and to do it around the delisting of the brown pelican to make that the issue. And so we're not patting ourselves on the back. These gentlemen can
right.
be there talking about the challenges they faced. And
actually, that's an I completely agree. Because of the issues around fully protected on at least two of these species, the legislature's going to have to deal with that. And so it would be nice for them to have the opportunity to kind of hear the discussions and understand the predicament that we're going to be in.
Well, this is actually a worldwide triumph. I mean, this is a wonderful thing to be able to recover the species of a species. Could it be a species of anything, plant included. So anyway, we need to facilitate that process.
If I could just remark on your last statement, the federal delisting is the California brown pelican is a subspecies. There are several other subspecies listed. The federal delisting is affecting all of them. So you're absolutely right. It's a new world issue.
It is. And I think it's something that's very invigorating and delightful that for all of us to finally be able to do something like this. It's a grand thing. Okay. Go ahead.
Commissioners, we have a request from our Bob from AGP Video to make a public comment before we close the meeting out.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I don't mean to delay your adjournment any longer than it is. I did want to point out we have a new feature on our broadcast, which is what we call the lower third or the bottom third. Here, I'll do this part here. Right here. This is a new feature to us. We included the logo for the California Fish and Game. And so we hope that makes the agenda items a little clearer to understand for the both webcast and rebroadcasting of this meeting. And we look for your input if any changes but this is a new feature that we're doing. Thank you so much.
Well, it'd be terrific if you could actually remove that portion of the meeting where I lost it when dealing with Mr. that would be a lot better. I must, granted, it is the case that I've had years of abuse from that gentleman. I apologize to everyone for having lost it. I genuinely did. I'm sorry about that. Thank you so much.
And you can see us after the meeting, and we can include a different form of verbiage that you have.
Oh,
in
good.
No, actually, there is no editing of these products.
Do you manufacture voting machines as well?
Anyway, thank you, commissioners and staff.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that little clip is on YouTube already, Richard. I'm not sure. Moving on to item 35, announcement of future meetings. Just would like to let the public know and remind the commissioners, February 13th, we will have a joint meeting with the Blue Ribbon Task Force in Pacifica. March 6th and 7th, our next full commission meeting will be in Stockton. April 10th and 11th, our full commission meeting will be in Bodega Bay. And we have set a date for April 15th, 10 a.m. Sherry, is that what we've announced? 10 a.m. for a teleconference of the commission to adopt ocean salmon regs. So that's Tuesday, April 15th. And that's where we are with the rest of our meetings for the rest of the year are on our website if you're interested in looking at that.
We ready? Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay. And since we have no quorum, we decide that we're adjourning. Thank you very much for coming, and it was a very productive 2 days.